This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dexter Filkins of the New York Times, just won a George Polk Award for war reporting for his coverage of the Battle of Fallujah. He was embedded with a Marine battalion. The award citation, which praises his riveting firsthand account of the 8-day attack, says, quote, "His courageous reports of the street-by-street fighting that killed 6 U.S. Marines and wounded 30 conveyed the hellish intensity of urban warfare underway in Iraq." Filkins has been covering Iraq for the New York Times for the past 2 years. In December, during a brief visit to the U.S., he talked with us about the Battle of Fallujah. After the holidays, he returned to Iraq to cover the election and the resulting political drama. We spoke again yesterday at the end of another brief trip back to the United States. Well, Dexter Filkins, congratulations on your award. Have you stayed in touch with any of the men who you were following who were fighting in Fallujah?
I have. It's been quite an experience since then. I've gotten dozens of emails and letters from the families of mostly of people who were killed there or wounded there, and also from the guys themselves and some of their families. But it's been quite moving, all these letters that I've gotten. Just a few days ago, I was invited to go to a memorial service for the 13 guys in Bravo Company who were killed there, and it just took place in this little gymnasium on the base, and the parents of the dead were there, and the wounded, and the whole unit, Bravo Company, about 150 guys were all there, and it was really something, you know, it was something to see them back home, but also, you know, just to have to remember the dead. And in particular, you know, there were some guys there who literally saved my life a couple of times, and so it was all very nice.
Did you speak there?
I didn't. I mean, there was kind of a reception afterwards, and I got to speak to a lot of the parents.
What are some of the things that they told you or that they wrote you?
Well, it was not what I would have expected. I've got a number of... You know, I wrote several stories about the things that had happened, and inevitably I wrote about some of the Marines who were killed and how they were killed. And I had a number of parents come up to me and also write to me and say, thank you very much for getting it down, and at least I know how my son died. There's something counterintuitive about that. I mean, it's very moving, but I just... You know, it's very painful, and it's must be. I can only imagine how painful it is for them to have a son killed, and yet they were incredibly grateful. It was all very moving.
Well, covering the elections has had its risks, and voting had its risks as well. I would like you to read a short excerpt of an article you wrote for the New York Times, that was datelined Election Day, January 30th, and if you could read just an excerpt for us.
It seemed simple enough, and the ease with which the Iraqis marked their ballots and dropped them into the box, and the quiet with which they filed out of their polling places, bespoke a long-suppressed yearning finally set free. If there were doubts about the ability of ordinary Iraqis to grasp the first principles of democratic rule, and about their own desire to govern themselves after decades of tyranny, they seemed to evaporate in the polling places of Karada. All through the day, the bombs kept exploding, audible from inside the polling places. Most of the time, the Iraqis did not even bother to look up. So inured were they to violence, and so immersed in their democratic moment. "Do you hear that? Do you hear the bombs?" said Hassan Jawad, a 33-year-old election worker at Lebanon High School, calling over the thud of an exploding shell. "We don't care. Do you understand? We don't care." "We all have to die," Mr. Jawad said. "To die for this, well, at least I will be dying for something." And then Mr. Jawad got back to work, guiding an Iraqi woman's hand to the ballot box.
Were a lot of people hurt on Election Day?
There were. I mean, I was struck by how amazing the security was. There were no cars allowed on the road anywhere in the entire country. So, for example, I went to a polling place in Karada, and I had to walk. I mean, and I think I walked 5 miles to get to this polling place. There were no cars allowed, which really, really helped. And there were thousands of Iraqi soldiers on the street and police officers. Every American, virtually, who was in the country was deployed. And so it was really something. I mean, it was really, you know, the great fear has been had been for months that this was going to be a day when there would be, you know, 50 car bombs, that the insurgents were going to just, were going to cut loose and they were going to unload everything they had. And it was going to wreck the election and it was going to turn the whole thing into a nightmare. And there were certainly intelligence reports to that effect leading up to the election. But it didn't work, really. I mean, there were a lot of car bombs, and there were suicide bombers, and there were mortar attacks. But for the most part, they were ineffectual.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what politics is like in Iraq now after the election. First, would you describe the Shiite coalition that won?
Well, it's kind of a grab bag. I mean, it's a big sprawling coalition with dozens of political parties, hundreds of candidates, half of whom are independent and don't belong to any party. And then you've got a number of parties in there, some of which are very Islamist-minded, some of which are pretty secular, some of which despise each other and hate each other and whose members have actually killed one another. And they were all kind of brought together under the guiding hand of the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who's the very powerful and revered religious leader in the country. And he kind of brought them together and said, essentially, this is our chance. We're we're a majority of the population here. Don't blow it. We've got a chance at power. And so this very various diverse coalition is kind of just barely holding together. They just got a little bit more than 50% of the vote. But the way the system is designed, the way it was designed by the Iraqis last year with some American help, 50% really isn't enough. They need basically two-thirds of the vote of the votes in the National Assembly to put together a government, and that's really important because what it means is that they're forced to compromise and they're forced to strike deals with other parties and other people who they don't necessarily see eye to eye with, and so that's why no government has yet emerged after the elections, which took place on January 30th. There's this very, very complicated and protracted bargaining process, which is going on. And I think, you're probably going to have some more of that, probably a few more weeks of that before a government emerges.
So who is the candidate that looks most likely to become prime minister?
Well, at the moment, there's a man named Ibrahim al-Jafari, who's the head of the coalition, and he's been announced as their candidate for prime minister. But I think it's a long way from being over. There's all sorts of many possibilities and many personalities who could still emerge. I mean, you have Ayad Alawi, who's the current prime minister. He could very easily remain the prime minister. You have Ahmed Chalabi, who's kind of circling out there with a number of supporters as well. And there's the bargaining and the dealing is so intense, and it's so various, and there's so many different possibilities that it's kind of hard to say at this point. But if you go to Jafari, he lived in London. He's a medical doctor. He's very much an Islamist and believes in and has spoke of the Islamization of Iraqi society. So I think that's given a lot of the secular candidates pause, and I think it's given the Americans pause as well. But again, the hopeful thing is under the rules that were designed in the interim constitution, which they're all following at the moment, Jafari and his coalition have to compromise to get into power, and so they're dealing with some very secular-minded parties that they have to strike deals with.
Well, what is the debate like now in Iraq about whether the government should be secular or Islamic?
Well, it depends on who you talk to, and in a way, if you just take a snapshot of how the vote turned out in Iraq, it's almost evenly divided between Islamic-minded parties, and that's mostly the Shiite parties. That's about 50%. And on arrayed against that, with almost the same number of votes, but not quite, is a number of mostly secular parties. There's Ayad Alawi's party. There's the Kurds, who are very secular. And so that's essentially what's being worked out at the moment. You basically have a kind of a tug of war.
Do you think that there's any likelihood of civil war in Iraq?
Well, I hate to try to predict, but there is, of course. I mean, Iraqi politicians certainly speak of it, and they certainly talk about it. And the most likely scenario for civil war, however likely civil war is, the most likely scenario for it is essentially the Sunnis versus the other two groups. In a way, in a very real way, you could say that civil war has already started there. I mean, essentially what you have is, you know, the Kurds and the Shiites who are kind of on board with this democratic experiment, and the Sunnis who aren't. And the insurgency is essentially Sunni-dominated insurgency versus the Shiites and the Kurds. That, in a way, is a very, it's already a low-level civil war. So it's a question, really, of how much more intense it gets. Personally, I don't see the signs yet that the country is headed towards, you know, something extraordinarily more violent than what's already happening. And I think that's probably unlikely as long as the American troops stay there.
Do you feel like the election changed the mind of many Iraqis who were hostile toward the United States because of the United States invasion and overthrow of Saddam Hussein?
Yes. I think what happened on Election Day and why it was so significant was the United States suddenly became less relevant. It wasn't as important, and it's not as important a player anymore in the eyes of the Iraqis. And what I mean is, before and really over the 22 months leading up to that election, the Americans were the rulers of that country, and so as the rulers, they were blamed for everything that went wrong. Whether it was the electricity that didn't work, or the water that didn't work, or the car bombings, America was blamed for everything. And what I detected when I was there, beginning immediately with Election Day, was first a kind of gratitude, which was a long time coming for a lot of Iraqis, a kind of a gratitude towards the United States for making the election actually happen. And second, there was a sense that there's an Iraqi government now. I mean, even if there really isn't, but this is our country again, and we're in charge, and our guys are responsible, and we're going to start blaming them, and we're not going to blame the Americans. And so it's a subtle, but it's a pretty important shift. I think the elections have kind of drained away a significant amount of the anger.
If you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times reporter Dexter Filkins. He's been covering Iraq for the past couple of years, and he's winning a George Polk Award for war reporting for his coverage of the Battle of Fallujah. There's a lot of attention right now, I think, being paid to the American checkpoints in Iraq as a result of the Italian journalist whose car was fired on right after she was released from being a hostage in Iraq, and she was injured, and one of the security men traveling with her was killed. Your colleague John Burns wrote about this in an article in the Times, and he said, next to the scandal of prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib, no other aspect of the American military presence in Iraq has caused such widespread dismay and anger among Iraqis. I'm sure you've been through your share of checkpoints in Iraq. What's the problem?
Well, it's almost a perfectly insoluble problem in a way. You have, on one hand, Iraqis driving down the road, most of whom, the overwhelming majority of whom, are completely innocent and law-abiding people, and they speak Arabic. On the other hand, you have American soldiers at a checkpoint who've been attacked repeatedly, often by suicide bombers, and they're terrified, and they're very, very tense, and they don't speak Arabic. And so you have, you know, often at night, and I've gone through these things at night, and they're really scary. You just have a lot of miscommunication. And everybody's, you know, the American soldiers, again, they've been attacked repeatedly. Their fingers are on the trigger. They don't feel like they should have to sacrifice their lives, again, to a suicide bomber. And so often you have these terrible misunderstandings, and they're very tragic, and Iraqis have been killed. And I've been through the checkpoints myself, and they can be really terrifying. And that's not to take anything away from the American soldiers, because if I were in their shoes, or if anybody I think were in their shoes, they'd probably act the same way. But they can be pretty terrifying. And I've interviewed Iraqi families that have been shot up for not doing anything wrong except misunderstanding the commands of the American soldiers, often in the darkness.
Can you give us a sense of what it's like to go through one of those American checkpoints?
Well, I'll give you one occasion. You'll just be driving down the road, and there'll be a checkpoint. There'll just be, you know, a couple of soldiers standing there, and they'll be stopping cars and pulling them and pulling cars over and kind of, you know, checking IDs and that sort of thing. Usually, I mean, overwhelmingly now, they're manned by Iraqis. And I have to say, that's much more terrifying. They're nowhere, the Iraqi soldiers and the Iraqi police officers are nowhere near as disciplined as the American soldiers are. I mean, they really are scared, and they really do shoot with not very much provocation. But I'll give you one experience that I had that was, there's a town north of Baghdad called Balad, and I was there, this is like a year ago, but I haven't forgotten it. I was just driving down the road in a car with some Iraqis, and we were coming up to an American checkpoint, and I don't know what happened, you know, I still don't know what happened. We crossed some kind of imaginary line, and it may have been that there was an American soldier who was telling us to stop, and we didn't see him, but in an instant, the American soldier who was sitting on top of a Humvee swung his 50 caliber machine gun towards our car and pulled back the lever. And I jumped out of the car and kind of put my hands up and, you know, started yelling and said, "Don't shoot, don't shoot." And he didn't shoot. But it was, you know, it was that close. It was that close. And actually, if I could give you another example, which I think is telling. And it would be better if we had video here, because I could show you. There's a common Iraqi hand signal to stop, and it's kind of holding your fingers up in the air and putting them together. And for every Iraqi, for every Arab, that means stop. The American military has a signal to stop, and it's a closed fist. And so you'll often see, as you're driving towards one of these checkpoints, you'll see an American soldier, very well intentioned, stick his fist out and point at a car, hoping that, expecting the Iraqi to understand that that means stop. But to the Iraqis, it doesn't mean stop. And so often they don't stop. And so that, you know, that's just one illustration of the sort of miscommunication that often happens at these checkpoints, and which often, or sometimes, ends tragically.
That does sound like the kind of thing that would be really easy to fix. You know, like the gesture for stop. Why couldn't the American military start using the Iraqi hand signal for stop?
You're hitting on a very important point, which I think is what's happened over the 2 years that I've been there is a kind of drawing back and a kind of a separation of one group from, or each group from the other, as the insurgency has become more violent and more bloody and more ruthless. American soldiers can't engage the Iraqi population in the way that they would like to, and in the way that they used to. And so what you often have, it just you know, heightens the possibility that there are going to be these kind of miscommunications going on, because basically the Iraqi people and American soldiers don't really talk to each other. And if only because everybody's afraid, you know, of insurgents and of the suicide bombers. It's really terrifying to be at one of those checkpoints, because I'm thinking in my mind right now, I'm thinking of driving to the airport, the Baghdad airport, and there's a series of checkpoints that are usually manned by the Americans. They are under attack almost every day, either by a suicide bomber, by a car bomber, or they come under fire, or they come under mortar fire. And it's just terrifying. I mean, it's absolutely relentless.
The Italian journalist who we just mentioned, you know, had been kidnapped by insurgents in Iraq and then released. And an interesting thing about that is that she was, you know, an openly anti-war journalist who worked for a communist publication. So here they are kidnapping somebody who, you know, probably would have seen herself as being on the same side they were, not siding with their violent approach, but, you know, against the invasion, you know. Did it surprise you that the insurgents were targeting a journalist who was against the invasion?
Well, it did and it didn't. If you look at who's been kidnapped, the journalists who have been kidnapped in Iraq, for the most part, it's European journalists. You've had a number of French journalists. There's still a French woman who's in captivity. You've had Italian journalists. You had the Italian NGO workers. You haven't had the Americans. And so in that sense, it's kind of puzzling. I happened to be in the same neighborhood as the Italian journalist on the day that she was kidnapped. I think these things and the evidence from a number of them suggest that these are targets of opportunity. And I could be wrong here, but I think the Italian journalist in this case had been, she'd been walking around for a bit and she'd been interviewing people. And the evidence in a number of these cases suggests that people see a Westerner and they think, we can get some money for this person if we kidnap him or we kidnap her. And again, the evidence suggests that that's what happens. Somebody grabs one of these journalists and then sells the journalist or sells whatever Westerner to a really terrible and awful group, which is willing to pay money for them. And so I think that's what's happening. So it's not like, you know, they check their credentials first and say, well, you work for a communist newspaper that's anti-American. You can go. I mean, I think it's mostly like they see a Westerner and people see a lot of cash.
So you're about to go back to Iraq. How do you mentally prepare to go back?
It feels like, you know, in a lot of ways when you're out, it feels like going back to like the fifth grade after a long summer vacation. And you just sort of brace yourself, you know, and the airplane. When you fly in the airplane to Baghdad International Airport, it's not a normal takeoff and landing. Basically, the plane lands like a dive bomber. It doesn't come in gradually because they're afraid of. They're routinely shot at, the commercial planes that come in, and so it's a special passenger jet that has a South African crew, and they basically fly directly overhead to the airport and then they dive, it's just like a dive bomber almost. It's almost a vertical drop into the airport. And so that kind of gets you ready as you do the vertical drop out of the sky into the airport. You know that it's about to begin, you know. But I try not to think about it until the moment when, you know, the plane hits the tarmac.
Is it any harder or easier to get around now than it was a couple of months ago when we last talked?
Well, the tension seems to have eased a bit, but really the answer is no. Basically, we can travel around Baghdad at great risk, in mortal danger. We can go around Baghdad. Usually now, you know, we take guards with us, armed guards, armored cars, that kind of thing. That's how you get around Baghdad. That's as good as it gets now. It's very difficult to move outside of Baghdad. When you go north or west, you're basically going into the Sunni Triangle. I mean, that's completely off limits. And even to go south, to drive south, you've got to go through a string of really awful towns where people have been killed and kidnapped and beheaded and attacked and any number of things. So the sense I get is that it's starting to change gradually. And, you know, we've had these kind of false dawns before when Saddam was captured. Things seemed to be getting better and then they got worse. When they handed over sovereignty to the Iraqis back in June, things seem to be getting better, and then they get worse again. And it's hard to say at this point. It's too early to say, really, whether this moment, the election, has sort of fundamentally changed things. It certainly feels, you know, in my gut, it feels like it has. But I think it's too soon to tell. It hasn't changed in terms of, like, our ability to move around. That's still incredibly difficult.
Are you living in the green zone?
No. People often ask me that, you know. Journalists don't live in the green zone. You know, we live in what's called the red zone, which is the real Iraq. You know, we live in a house that has enormous concrete walls, blast walls around it, barbed wire, armed guards, searchlights. We live in a house like that. And so basically every time we leave the compound, as soon as we leave the compound, we're in danger.
So how often a day do you leave?
I keep, you know, I leave every day. I mean, I go out every day. It's just the nature of it has changed. I mean, it used to be, you know, that you could just go out. You could go to a neighborhood like Karada, where I went on election day, and you could walk around and you could just stop people on the sidewalk and say, well, what do you think about this? You know, and you can't do that now, for the most part. You could on election day, which was one of the things that was so wonderful about it was just this kind of street party atmosphere. But that's still really pretty much off limits. You can do a little bit of it. You just have to be very fast. Get out of your car, talk to a handful of people, get back in your car, get out of there and maybe go to another neighborhood or something. Look in the rearview mirror. Make sure nobody's following you. Typically, when I go out now, I go in an armored car with a guard. And then I have a car, a chase car, behind with a couple of more guards. And that, you know, that's kind of the nature of working there. If you want to have any kind of extended discussion with somebody, you've got to basically set up an appointment and go to their house. They're usually too afraid to come to our place, but go to their house and sit inside, you know. And so it's a very sort of truncated experience.
One more question. While you've been in the States on this brief visit, if you've watched the news, what are some of the stories that have struck you as being most ridiculous, considering what you're witnessing every day in Iraq?
I think I would answer that in a different way. I've been reading the papers and watching television really closely when I've been here, and you know there's Michael Jackson and Martha Stewart, and they're all kind of but those are kind of fun to watch and fun to read about. But I think what is strangest for me, and because I sort of feel like, I mean, I've been in Iraq for a couple of years, and I almost feel like a veteran, I think, and I'm not. I mean, I don't fight, and God knows I don't get shot at the way that those guys do. But it's this. Going into Iraq is like kind of an out-of-body experience. I mean, you sort of leave the known world. You know, you get on this spacecraft and you go to this distant world where there's no phone lines and there's no connection with the real world. And it's this incredibly intense experience. And I'm sure this is exactly what's felt, or pretty close, what is felt by American soldiers. And you're in this thing and it's you know, incredibly intense. And it's very violent. And people are dying and so much is at stake. And then you come out and you land in America, where everything is so easy, and it's nice and it's comfortable, and yeah, you know, the biggest thing going on is Martha Stewart and Michael Jackson. And what's weird is that if you're in a place like Manhattan, where I am now, people don't really talk about the war very much, you know. And then you can go to a place like Camp Lejeune in North Carolina, the Marine base there, and it's, you know, the whole area, Jacksonville, North Carolina. It's all military families. There's big billboards, and everybody's involved in it. And so there's kind of a weird, I could be wrong, but I mean, it just seems like there's a weird disconnect in a lot of the country over this war, that the sacrifices are being borne unequally by people, and there isn't a lot of sacrifices made by some others. And so that results in this kind of bifurcated, you know, strange sort of two-tiered nature, you know, of the country when you come back. And it's just very jarring. It really is.
Dexter Filkins, thank you so much. Good luck to you, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And congratulations again on your award.
Thank you.
Dexter Filkins is a reporter for the New York Times and has been covering Iraq for the past 2 years. He just won a George Polk Award for war reporting. Our conversation was recorded yesterday.